This is the State of Things broadcasting from Blue Ridge Public Radio in downtown Asheville. I'm Frank Stachow. Last week, Congress passed a bill to provide Hurricane Harvey disaster relief, raise the government's borrowing limit, and fund the government for three more months. 90 Republicans in the House voted against that measure, including Representative Mark Meadows from Western North Carolina. Mark Meadows is the chair of the far-right House Freedom Caucus and one of two influential congressmen from western part of the state. The other one is Representative Patrick McHenry, who is acting majority whip in the House. And these are two North Carolina representatives with increasing influence in national politics, and in many ways they represent some of the tensions within the Republican Party. Joining me now is Jeremy Loeb. He is the host of Morning Edition and a reporter for Blue Ridge Public Radio and public radio here in Asheville.
Good
Welcome,
to be
Jeremy.
With you, Frank.
Good to be back. Have you back on the show? Tell us about this vote last week, because Mark Meadows votes against that measure for disaster relief, but of course it's tied to the raising the debt ceiling.
Yeah, that's correct. A 3-month extension. That was a deal worked out by President Donald Trump and Democrats, actually, a deal with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. So, of course, anything where there's a deal with Schumer and Pelosi, Congressman Mark Meadows, who, as you mentioned, is chair of the House Freedom Caucus, is probably not going to be very happy about that. So he did, we should be clear, he did vote for hurricane relief for Harvey and Irma before it was tied to this raising of the debt ceiling.
But this is interesting because it raises the question to what degree we thought of the Freedom Caucus as the best buddy for Donald Trump, and certainly coming into office they were, and now we see some of the tension between the two.
Yeah, well, people who watch Washington are trying to figure out what's in the mind of Donald Trump all the time, and right now he does seem to be making more deals with Democrats. There's, of course, the vote on DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and he seems to be possibly making a deal with Democrats on that as well, and that could put him at odds with Mark Meadows again. Now, Mark Meadows is a strong ally of Donald Trump, and they may disagree on certain things. I'm not sure if this represents a real rift between them, but it's something to look at for sure.
One of their disagreements is who to endorse for that U.S. Senate race in Alabama. Mark Meadows endorsed Roy Moore, right?
Yeah, that's right. Roy Moore is a very conservative guy out of Alabama. He's the Chief Justice in Alabama, and he's most well known for putting up a monument of the Ten Commandments at the Alabama Supreme Court and defying a judge's order to remove it. Also, it actually got him removed from office, and now he was reelected in Alabama, and he was suspended recently because he opposed the legalization of same-sex marriage. After it was legalized, he ordered probate judges to keep enforcing a same-sex marriage ban.
Mark Meadows pays attention to the details, but apparently lost track of this one. He accidentally signed the amicus brief urging the U.S. Supreme Court to curb partisan gerrymandering.
Yeah, very interesting. I don't know how that happens, but he says that he was reviewing it. It was a miscommunication. Somehow his name ended up on this amicus brief, and he wasn't the only one. Walter Jones, also from Eastern North Carolina, said the same thing. So there were two of three North Carolina congressmen. David Price of Durham was the other one. He said his name got on there on purpose. So how did his name end up on this thing? I'm not sure. He was also quoted in the amicus brief. The quotes were generic enough that it doesn't mean that he helped form it or anything. But it's very interesting because, of course, if he's coming out against gerrymandering, his district was created to, basically help him get elected. He went out of his way to say that he supports the North Carolina General Assembly who drew that district for him.
All right. Well, let's do a little compare and contrast here because, as we said, Mark Meadows, of course, very influential now in Congress. The Freedom Caucus is a powerful group in the House. And then we have Patrick McHenry, who is now the acting whip, right?
Yeah, because of the shooting of Steve Scalise, he's in recovery right now. McHenry is acting whip, so, basically that means that he's in charge of gathering up the votes, making sure the GOP agenda passes through the House. He's had some mixed results on that. But he would be considered someone who comes from sort of the establishment wing of the Republican Party, which puts him at the opposite end of the spectrum, at least as far as Republicans go. Also a conservative, though, of course.
And how do they compare, would you say, this is interesting because they're both sort of represent this part of the state. They also represent, to some extent, the friction and factions within the Republican Party. To what extent does that represent what's going on here politically in Western North Carolina?
Well, I think it's... know, it's this thing that's been going on for a while, this battle brewing between Republicans on the national level. We are kind of a microcosm of that with these two members. So, you know, at some points they're at odds, and other ways they agree, but it definitely puts them at opposite ends of that spectrum.
We're going to move on, too, and talk about other stories here in Western North Carolina. I want to take a look at news in Buncombe County. And joining me now is Jennifer Bowman. She is Buncombe County government reporter for the Asheville Citizen-Times. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
You're covering a story about a federal investigation into Buncombe County manager Wanda Green. Tell us more about that.
Well, there isn't that many details that have been released. It was announced about a month ago that there was an investigation into the former county manager, about roughly a month after she had retired, seemingly with no controversy, a pretty well-liked person, good reputation as far as finances go. And since then, they've been pretty tight-lipped, basically just confirming that there's been an investigation into Green and others, is how the U.S. Attorney's Office has characterize that.
The county commissioners then recently met with a high-profile attorney, and that became the source of some controversy, right?
Yeah. There seems to be some differing opinions on whether that closed session was legal. Sean Devereaux is a pretty well-known name, a high-profile attorney here in town who obviously, when he shows up at a meeting, his face can be recognized. So they entered into a closed session citing attorney-client privilege. The only problem with that is that Sean Devereaux has not been hired or retained by the county. So the Press Association attorney, Amanda Martin, argues that you can't have attorney-client privilege if you don't have an attorney-client relationship. The county attorney's position is that it was a legal closed session and that that may be too strict of an interpretation. They've left it pretty open on whether he'll be retained. He is not at this point, and as of 2 days ago, had not billed the county.
Let's talk more about Wanda Green, who is under investigation. What was her tenure like as county manager?
Certainly, I don't think it was without controversy. There were some issues about, you know, trying to slide in a pay raise that eventually she let go of last year. But she improved the county's bond rating. She's been described by county commissioners as the best county manager in the state, maybe even the country, and was pretty well liked and applauded, you know, when she left. So it does come as a surprise, I think, when you get this bombshell that with very few details that there's a federal criminal investigation.
You've also been covering a story about a new solar farm acquired. Well, it's not a solar farm. What they acquired was a landfill, Duke Energy, that they would like to turn into a solar farm. Tell us about that story, because that has become controversial. The idea of turning, you would think, a landfill into a solar farm would be something that would be joyous news to this part of the country.
Which is exactly how that conversation started. You know, the county being able to go green, to do something with land that you otherwise really can't do much. It's pretty limited as far as development goes. But those talks started with Duke Energy specifically. And as the process went out, you know, county commissioners raised some questions about transparency, about the lack of a bid process. So in a split vote, they decided to move forward with a bid process. And a couple weeks ago, it turned out really to be just kind of where they started, where Duke actually gave the best bid to the county.
Well, and again, the question is who's going to bid on a landfill, right? I mean, that's part of it. In other words, but the very serious question is, what are the other uses for a landfill?
Yeah, not much. Yeah. You know, some municipalities have looked at closed landfills, and if the land is kind of flat, you can do some recreation, you can do some things like that. But other than that, it's pretty limited. So this, you know, you can't even, the solar panels will, you can't penetrate the land. So you have to, you know, place them on these cement blocks, basically. So there isn't much you can do with it. And what Duke proposes is, you know, for 25 years, depending on how much acres, you know, $700 an acre lease agreement, they could make $500,000 when the lease is done.
What about the landfill is unique? I mean, we're now talking about a toxic site, so it's not about a cleanup and the expense that's, you know, associated with that. Are there other complications in terms of how you build, and perhaps your carbon footprint is a little higher because of the way you have to put in solar panels on a landfill, right?
Yeah. It was described to me that it's not where you want to build a house with a bunch of basements.
Okay.
And so, you know, the training facility nearby kind of has a system in place that kind of tracks what's underneath and what can be, you know, if something moves, they have a system in place where they want to kind of get to that as quick as they can.
Well, the nice thing is if you move a couple of inches left or right, it's coming from the top down. So the sun pretty much is always going to shine on you.
Sure.
Unlike the cracks that you can get in your foundation if you go a half an inch left or right. Right. So what are the next steps now?
A feasibility study. There's 30 acres that they think they could work with, but they have to look at what the nearby substation can handle, how much, you know, energy they can actually produce there. A lot of engineering stuff needs to be done before you'll see any construction start.
Have they speculated at all about how much energy they might produce from this?
Yeah, they're thinking, you know, in terms where you can understand, you know, as much as 750 homes could be powered by this.
And what would be the timeline if they could get going now?
They couldn't tell you.
They can't tell you. Because there is no now in this kind of a project, I guess. Well, so we're talking a little bit about this. We've talked about some political news here in Western North Carolina, but I want to hear about some scientific developments brewing in the state as well. Blue Ridge Public Radio reporter and host Helen Chickering has been following some of those stories. Helen, welcome. Good to have you here.
Oh, thanks, Frank. Great to be back.
Tell us, talk about this experimental farm in Waynesville, North Carolina, that you went out to visit. There's some interesting stuff going on there.
Yeah, it's called the Mountain Research Station. There's 18 across the state. It's supported by the Department of Agriculture and grant money. 400 acres, rolling hills. They grow everything from cattle to Christmas trees. Looks just like a regular farm till you get on site and you see plots and markers and signs and you realize there's a lot of research going on.
Research for what? What's the point?
Well, the one thing they do, think about this place is like a test farm for a test kitchen for farmers, right? So farmers come up with a new pest or they need a new herbicide, and so they will test that so farmers don't have to foot the bill. But they're also looking for new and emerging crops. So they've got ear to the ground of the agriculture community, and they're listening. And so farmers say, you know, we've had some luck with this or this, but we'd like to really see if it's viable. And they will do that research, plan it, figure it out, so farmers don't have to foot the financial burden.
But this is interesting because it means somebody is placing a bet on economic development rooted in agriculture. We thought we were getting away from that. But
absolutely. Well, yeah. And it is this section of the program that has really kept the public's interest. Think of it as like the craft beers of agriculture, right? So hot crops that the public wants to, you know, put on their plate. So that's kind of what they're investing in right now. I mean, truffles is one of them.
Truffles and hot crops that you might want to put into your hammock. Hemp,
yes,
as well.
Hemp is another one. Hemp is
I
a
didn't
big
say
one.
Bong, I said hammock.
No, you did not. And that's very, very sensitive subject. There
of
is a
course.
Big difference, although the plants look the same. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now it's legal to grow and to cultivate industrialized hemp. And so that is happening. And on this farm, they're testing 15 varieties for their testing for seeds to see which plants grow best for different uses. So, and they're having lots of luck.
And is there anything about the environment and the soil here in Western North Carolina that makes it either well suited, or part of the question could be, well, maybe not now, but suppose we found a variety that works well here?
That's exactly what they're doing. So hemp and other crops do better up north, where the summer days are longer and the climate is a bit cooler. So it doesn't mean you can't grow it here. It means you need to find or cultivate those varieties that will make it here, and that's what they're doing right now.
Let's get back to the truffles, because talk about cultivation. That is a you know, a tricky and persnickety little varmint.
Yes, they grow underground. They have to, yes, and we're not talking the chocolate kind, although.
Yeah.
They grow underground. They grow alongside roots of certain trees, hazelnut and oak trees, and they have had an orchard in place at this farm since 2010. And they're having a bit of luck. They're having some trouble. The trees are thriving. They know that they've got the fungus growing down below, but they're having a hard time getting regular fruit production.
Yeah, fungus is really, about thwarting every effort to cultivate.
You know?
And so truffle would be that. Is there anything about the environment here that makes hazelnut and oak tree the right thing? In other words, do you say to yourself, oh, well, if they're associated with those two trees, they're native to us, why don't we find a way? Or do you, again, cultivate a particular tree that's going to give you the truffle?
That's what they're trying. I know that there's a pH issue with our soil. They're having to add lots of lime, but they're also looking beyond those two trees. I think, though, hazelnut and oak, too, are the ones that they're determined to make work. There is a truffle orchard in your neck of the woods, and that's where these trees came from.
There you go. And so what about, I also understand that the other problem with truffles would be harvesting.
Yes. So traditionally pigs, you know, people, because they're underground, you can't keep digging holes, right? So they are training dogs. So that is the big thing now, is they're training dogs to sniff out truffles, and they've had a lot of success.
One more experiment we want to talk about, which is an experiment around hops.
Yes. Wouldn't that be fantastic if it could make it here?
Hemp and hops.
Yes. So brewers are foaming at the mouth for this to work. Unfortunately, hops has the same challenge as hemp. They like those longer days. They like cooler climates. So they've actually got a breeder on site trying to figure out or cultivate varieties that will like our climate. And that is, remember, this is an experimental, it's a research right. farm. It will take time.
But again, going back to the initial point, a research farm rooted in the idea that there is economic development in agriculture. So this is a very exciting thing. Another science story that you've been following is about storms. You met with Rob Young, a professor at Western Carolina University who studies coastlines, owing to the fact that soon the coastline will be here, I guess, in Western North Carolina. He's a professor there, but he's calling for an overhaul of how we measure and talk about hurricanes, right?
Yes, he is. There's a thing called the Saffir-Simpson scale. He'll talk about it.
Well, let's listen to this.
I think that we should throw the 1 to 5 Saffir-Simpson rating out the window. It really doesn't tell the whole story. The Saffir-Simpson scale does tell you about the wind speed, but it doesn't tell you really anything about what the potential storm surge might be. It doesn't tell you anything about how much precipitation the storm will drop. So it really doesn't do a very good job on its own of characterizing the potential impacts and whether a storm is going to be catastrophic or not.
That's Rob Young, the director of the Program for the Study of the Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University. I'm speaking with Blue Ridge Public Radio reporter Helen Chickering. So tell us more about that. We've got this rating, but apparently the fact that we're mostly thinking about the winds is what Rob is concerned about.
Right. And so that's the scale that we hear on television, on the radio. And you think, 1, you don't worry so much. By the time we hear 3, we start to get worried. But it really is based on sustained wind speed. And Rob said there are many other factors that determine the potential strength and the damage a hurricane can do. Everything from the size of the storm to the shape of the land that it hits. So if it hits a flat piece of land, it might disperse. If it hits, you know, a concave piece of land, storm surge might be bigger. So he says that this one number does not paint the whole picture.
Any traction? Does he have a suggestion? And there's anybody in the world who agrees with him?
Lots of people agree. I think, you know, we're talking again about how we communicate to the public, and it's hard to sort of water down right. that complicated message. But what he would like to see is you say that, and then you add storm surge potential. You add precipitation potential. Look at Harvey. Harvey was right. thought to be a windstorm. It turned out to be, especially for Texas, a rainstorm.
A rainstorm that stuck around. So is right. it moving fast or slow? Is it going to hang around or not?
And those numbers, he says, do not reflect that. And we tend to either overreact or get a false sense of security based on that number.
Jeremy Loeb, I want to ask you one more question before we finish here, because I know you did a feature recently about climate change and hurricanes, and you talked to people in Nashville about their feelings about all that.
Well, you guys were just talking about Hurricane Harvey that dropped a record amount of rainfall on the Houston, Texas area, and then just a week later, we had the strongest maybe ever recorded hurricane in the Atlantic Ocean with Hurricane Irma. So the question for me was, what role does climate change play in these storms? And it's politically toxic to talk about that because climate change has become so politically polarizing. Even Donald Trump's EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, suggested that it's insensitive to talk about climate change while people are recovering from the devastation of a storm. So I spoke to some climate scientists here in Asheville. Asheville is sometimes called Climate City. We have so many climate scientists here. NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information is here. That was formerly the National Climatic Data Center. Eileen Shea had told me, who had been with NOAA for a long time, told me that now is the time to talk about climate change. With the warmer ocean, it means that these storms can be stronger and they can last longer.
And it even means something up here in the mountains away from the coast, that clearly this is an area that's affected where none of us are not affected. I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Jeremy Loeb is Morning Edition host and reporter for Blue Ridge Public Radio. Helen Chickering is a reporter and host with Blue Ridge Public Radio as well. And Jennifer Bowman is Buncombe County Government Reporter for the Asheville Citizen Times. Thank all of you for being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, we are going to hear 2 concert pianists who are sisters. Kimberly and Michelle Kahn will be with me live in the studio, and 2 very big Steinway pianos. All of that on the State of Things. Stay tuned.